Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful. Clear your doubts about Islam. 50 answers to common questions. Compiled by Sahih International. Page 67. Question number 41. Are men and women considered equal? When replying to this question, we must first define what is meant by equal and identify the aspect which worries us in terms of gender equality. Islam regards women as spiritual and intellectual equals of men. For a Muslim, the important issue is who can become closest to God and earn the greatest reward. The Quran answers, whoever does deeds of righteousness, whether male or female, while being a believer, those will enter paradise, and not the least injustice will be done to them. For Muslim men and women, for devout men and women, for truthful men and women, for patient men and women, for humble men and women, for charitable men and women, for fasting men and women, for chaste men and women, and for men and women who remember God often. For them has Allah prepared forgiveness and a great reward. There is no difference between men and women. As far as their relationship to God is concerned, both are equal before God and they are both accountable before Him. Women, like men, are commanded to worship God and both are promised the same rewards and punishments according to their intention and conduct. Economically, every man and woman is an independent legal entity. Both men and women have the right to own property, engage in business, and inherit from others. Both have the equal right to receive an education and enter into gainful employment. Seeking knowledge is an obligation upon every Muslim, and to prevent women from getting an education is contrary to the teachings of Islam. However, one fact mentioned in the Quran and now recognized is that all things are created in pairs. Had there been a similar function for all, the creation of two counterparts would not have been necessary. Had there been a similar function for all, the creation of two counterparts would not have been necessary. To ignore inherent physical and psychological differences is surely unrealistic, but there is no reason to assume that one sex is superior to the other. The creation of male and female means a natural division of function, meaning distinct roles for each, which are both complementary and collaborative. Thus, absolute equality between men and women in all matters is neither possible nor reasonable. But this does not mean bias in favor of men to the detriment of women. While some rulings may be seen to favor men, many others favor women. However, most Islamic rulings apply to men and women equally, and both are bound by their obligations towards one another. The main distinction between the two sexes is in the physical realm based on the equitable principle of fair division of labor. Islam allots the more strenuous work to the man and makes him responsible for the maintenance of the family. It allots the work of managing the home and the upbringing and training of children to the woman, work which has the greatest importance in the task of building a healthy and prosperous society. It is also true that sound administration within any organization requires a unified policy under a just executive. For this reason, Islam expects the husband as head of the household to consult with his family and then have the final say in decisions concerning it. This degree of authority is in no way means that the Creator prefers men over women, but is simply the logical way of apportioning responsibilities in a household. Men and women are two equally important component parts of humanity, and the rights and responsibilities of both sexes in Islam are equitable and balanced in their totality. Although their obligations might differ in certain areas of life in accordance with basic physical and psychological differences, each one is equally accountable for his or her particular responsibilities. Footnote: God is neither male nor female. Gender is an attribute of creation, but not the creator. The use of the pronoun he for God here is a linguistic one, used in the Quran and accepted by Muslims as such. Question number 42. Why does Islam keep women behind the veil? The Islamic veil or hijab refers to the loose-fitting, opaque outer garments. The Islamic veil or hijab refers to the loose-fitting, opaque outer garments with which a Muslim woman covers her head and body. Footnote: while basically the same as the clothing depicted in traditional Christian representations of the Virgin Mary, this type of dress is currently singled out as a sign of Islamic extremism. Muslim women cover themselves with such garments before all men apart from their closest relatives. They do not do so to please their fathers, brothers, or husbands, but only because God has ordained it. In reality, Islam did not introduce modest dress, but merely endorsed it as part of God's religion. Yet, dress is only one aspect of a total concept. Hijab is not merely a concealing garment, but includes proper behavior, manners, speech, and appearance in public. In order to accept any law or instruction, a person needs either to be convinced of the benefit behind it, or to trust in the wisdom of the one who prescribed it. Muslims believe that the wisdom of God is absolute and perfect, and that He knows the nature and best interests of His creations, mankind included, better than they do themselves. Thus, a believer willingly obeys God's directives as much as he or she is able. To some, the matter of woman's dress might seem trivial. Islam, however, assigns to it moral, social, and legal dimensions. When women observe the proper Islamic dress, they protect their own honor and reputation and contribute greatly towards peace and order in society. Modesty is a virtue. Modesty is a virtue which Islam demands of both men and women, not only for the protection of women, but to maintain the spiritual uprightness of men. In view of the sexual anarchy that prevails in many parts of the world, the need for modest dress and behavior in both men and women is obvious. However, on account of differences between males and females in nature and temperament, a greater amount of privacy is required for women than for men, and this relates, among other things, to their manner of dress. Islam has no fixed standard. Islam has no fixed standard as to the style of dress or type of clothing that must be worn. However, it must be wide and thick enough as not to reveal the contours of the figure. Muslim women are responsible for making their homes attractive and comfortable, and Islam encourages a woman to beautify herself for her husband and immediate family members rather than publicly exhibiting her physical charms and worldly possessions. Muslim women who cover themselves do not find it impractical or interfering with their activities in the various fields of life. It is often forgotten that the modern Western style of dress is a recent phenomenon. Looking at the clothing of women as recently as 70 years ago, we see that it is similar to the dress prescribed by Islam. Those hard-working, active Western women were not at all inhibited by their long full dresses and head coverings. The covering of women's bodies is not a logical basis. The covering of women's bodies is not a logical basis on which to claim that women are subservient to men. The covering of women's bodies is not a logical basis on which to claim that women are subservient to men. It would be far more appropriate to charge a society with exploitation of females when it tolerates pornography rather than when it encourages modesty. It is ironic that uncontested freedom is granted to those who choose to publicly expose much of their bodies, while severe censure is launched against women who consider that modest covering is a religious obligation that cannot be disregarded. Islam teaches that women are to be evaluated for their intelligence, opinions, skills, deeds, and inner qualities rather than physical appearance. A Muslim woman who covers her body is making a statement about herself and her identity. She has dignity, respectability, self-esteem, and is proud of her Islam. Whoever sees her will know that she is not available to men or interested in advances, that she has an upright moral character, and that she will not permit sexuality to enter into any of her necessary interactions with the opposite sex. Women often see their Islamic dress as empowering because they are taken seriously and respected rather than being viewed as sex objects. They are judged only by their character and conduct. 43. Why is a Muslim man allowed to have more than one wife? Although it is found in many religious and cultural traditions, polygamy is most often identified with Islam in the minds of Westerners. However, one does not find any limit to the number of wives in the Talmud, Bible, Hindu scriptures, or others. Therefore, polygamy is not something exclusive to Islam. There was no restriction on Hindu men regarding the number of wives until 1954, when Indian civil law made it illegal for a non-Muslim to have more than one wife. It continued among the Jewish Sephardic communities until as late as 1950, when an act of the chief rabbinate of Israel declared it unlawful to marry more than one wife. And Christian men were originally permitted to take as many wives as they wished, since the Bible placed no limit on the number. It was only in recent centuries that the church limited the number of wives to one. Unrestricted polygamy has been practiced in most human societies throughout the world until fairly recently. In a world which allowed men an unlimited number of wives, it was Islam which limited the number to four. Before the Quran was revealed, there was no upper limit, and many men had scores of wives, some into the hundreds. Islam placed the limit as four and gave a man permission to marry two, three, or four on the condition that he must deal with all of them benevolently and fairly, as indicated in the Quran. But if you fear that you will not be just, then marry only one. The Quran is the only religious book that says marry only one. The idea that it is compulsory for a Muslim man to have more than one wife is a misconception. Polygamy falls into the category of things that are permissible but not obligatory. Taking an additional wife is neither encouraged nor prohibited. Islam allows a man to marry up to four wives, provided he can support them all adequately and treat each one fairly. Just and fair treatment involves what is within the husband's ability, such as the time spent with each, expenditures, gifts, etc. If he knows or even fears that he will be unable to do so, it is not permissible for him to marry more than one wife. This Quranic directive strengthens the position of the family and of the women, for it provides legal security for many women who would otherwise remain unmarried. It is a known fact that the world female population is now more than the male population. Infant mortality rates among males are higher when compared to that of females. During wars, more men are killed as compared to women. More men die due to accidents and diseases than women. More men die due to accidents and diseases than women. The average lifespan of females is longer than that of males. Thus, at almost any given time and place, there is a shortage of men in comparison to women. And when men are taken out of the marriage market by wars or economic difficulties, it is women who suffer. Footnote: love and physical attraction are matters of the heart, usually beyond a man's ability to control. Therefore, those differences are excused. Not excused, however, is an obvious display of favor or aversion toward one in particular, or injustice in terms of their marital rights. Equal treatment of each remains a strict condition. What are women of honor and self-respect to do in such situations when men are taken out of the marriage market by wars or economic difficulties? It is women who suffer. So, what are women of honor and self-respect to do in such situations? How can they fulfill their natural desire to have companionship and sexual relations without resorting to fornication, adultery, lesbianism, or other perverted practices? The only options open to unmarried women are to remain deprived of a relationship for the rest of their lives, to become public property, or to marry a married man. Islam prefers giving women the advantage by permitting and facilitating legal marriage and prohibiting irresponsible relationships. The Western instance on monogamy is essentially false. In their societies today, it is not uncommon for a man to have extramarital relations with girlfriends, with girlfriends, mistresses, or prostitutes. Seldom is this disapproved of, despite the harm that comes about from it. Soaring divorce rates, broken homes, deadbeat dads, increasing numbers of children born out of wedlock, and the spread of sexually transmitted diseases are just a few of the negative consequences of this common practice. Additionally, the woman in such a relationship has no legal rights. She will easily be cast aside to fend for herself should she become pregnant or when the man simply tires of her. Within marriage, the woman has a husband who is obligated by law to provide for her and her children. There is no doubt that a second wife lawfully married and treated honorably is better off than a mistress without any legal rights or social respect. Islam has allowed more than one wife in order to protect society from immorality and to uphold the honor and dignity of women. Polygamy protects the interests of women and children within society and also prevents the spread of venereal diseases, herpes and AIDS, which are rampant in promiscuous societies where extramarital affairs abound. After World War II, when suggestions to legalize polygamy were rejected by the church in Germany, prostitution was legalized in a state. The rate of marriage has been steadily declining there as the new generation finds marriage increasingly unnecessary and irrelevant. Yet polygamy continues to be banned even though it preserves the honor and chastity of women. In Western societies, men prefer to keep polygamy illegal because it absolves them of responsibility. Legalized polygamy would require them to spend for the maintenance of their additional wives and offspring, while the status quo allows them to enjoy extramarital affairs without economic consequence. Granted, there is the problem of natural jealousy among wives. However, they are encouraged to overcome it to the best of their ability on the principle of liking for others what one would like for oneself. If the first wife should find such a situation unbearable, she has the option of requesting divorce, and an unmarried woman is not under obligation to accept the proposal of a man already married. She is free to decide for herself. In some societies, a wife will seek a second wife for her husband to be a companion for herself and share in some of her responsibilities. Islam takes the society as a whole into consideration, seeking to maximize benefit and reduce harm. As long as there are certain individual and social problems whose solution lies in the taking of an additional wife, it cannot be prohibited. Yet, in spite of its legality in most Muslim countries, it is a small minority of Muslims that actually enter into a second marriage, as most men cannot afford the expense of maintaining more than one wife or one family. 44. Question number 44. Why does Islam prohibit a woman from having more than one husband? Some people question the logic of allowing Muslim men to have more than one spouse while denying the same right to women. While almost every society has supported the concept of a man having more than one woman, seldom has any social order ever supported the concept of a woman being married to two or more men at the same time. The foundation of an Islamic society is justice and equity. God created men and women equal as human beings, but not identical in nature. They have innate differences physiologically and psychologically, and have different capabilities. Hence, their roles and responsibilities may differ, but they serve to complement one another. A feminist might object to the male's right to more than one wife by insisting that women should also be able to practice polyandry, which is the marriage to more than one husband. However, the following few points should be considered. As mentioned earlier, one of the benefits of polygamy is that it deals with the problem of women outnumbering men. Conversely, polyandry would only add to this problem if several men who are already in short were to marry one of the women who are in abundance. In general, men are more polygamous by nature than women and have greater sexual needs. Islam assigns great importance to the recognition of both parents. When a man has more than one wife, the parents of children born in the marriage can easily be identified. But in the case of a woman marrying more than one husband, only the mother of the children would be known. How would a child of such a marriage know who his father was without resorting to laboratory tests? Would he accept his mother identifying the father by some chance method? Although recent advances in science have made it possible for both the mother and father to be identified through genetic testing, for a married woman to have to inquire who the father of her child is in order to register him in school or get medical care seems impractical, to say the least. In addition, psychologists tell us that children who do not know their parents, the father in particular, undergo mental disturbances and trauma and often have unhappy childhoods. Biologically, it is not difficult for a man to perform his duties as a husband despite having several wives. Biologically, it's not difficult for a man to perform his duties as a husband despite having several wives. But a woman having several husbands would find it very difficult, if not impossible, to perform all her duties as a wife to each one of them. Complying when each husband desired intimacy with her at various times, keeping house for each one and looking after all of their children would undoubtedly be problematical. These issues become obvious with a bit of reflection. Moreover, it has now been medically proven that one of the major causes of the serious diseases which have become so widespread is women having intercourse with more than one man and the mixing of seminal fluids in the womb. Hence, the Quran has prescribed a waiting period for the woman who has been divorced or widowed so that enough time passes for her womb to be cleansed of any traces of the former husband before she marries again. Question 45. How can a Muslim be happy? Happiness is a feeling that resides in the heart. It is characterized by peace of mind, tranquility, a sense of full being, and a relaxed disposition. From an Islamic perspective, it is of two levels, worldly pleasure and eternal happiness. A believer's focus is usually more on eternal happiness, although it does not mean that Muslims forfeit the good things for the present life. Islam does not deny the importance of material causes for enjoyment, except that they are not an essential requirement for it. Material things are merely among the means that might contribute to it. The Sharia lays down a number of directives and guidelines to secure man's happiness during his life on earth, and at the same time, Islam teaches that the benefits of this world may be used as a means to attain happiness in the eternal life of the hereafter by sharing them with others and showing gratitude to God. A Muslim finds his greatest happiness and contentment in his faith, and this certainly applies to the present life as well as the next. Someone who believes in God with a belief that is pure and free from any defects will enjoy a tranquil heart. Someone who believes in God with a belief that is pure and free from any defects will enjoy a tranquil heart, a peaceful soul, and will be pleased with whatever God has provided for him. Submission to the will of God, which is the meaning of Islam, gives the believer the peace of mind needed in order to be industrious and persevering, aware that his life has meaning and a definite purpose. He is motivated to expend effort in order to realize it. His enhanced perception of the moments, hours, and days of his life leaves no place for boredom or depression. Faith also protects a Muslim against the causes of unhappiness. A believer is mentally prepared to accept patiently whatever God should decree for him. He knows that he will be tried and tested throughout his life, and additionally that those trials are opportunities for him to put his faith into practice and earn rewards not proportionate to, but many times greater than his suffering. Such tests help him to develop inner strength through patience and determination, trusting in God, seeking his assistance and fearing him alone. The life of this world fluctuates between periods of ease and difficulty, just as an individual does from health to illness or from wealth to need and vice versa. Additionally, man is a social being who needs to interact with others of his own kind. Because individuals differ in their physical and mental qualities, it is unavoidable that there will be some displeasing occurrences among them, causing sorrow and distress. If people cannot deal with problems in an even-handed and principled manner, their dealings with others can become a great source of misery. For this reason, Islam emphasizes the development of strong moral character and endeavors to develop in its followers a balanced and harmonious emotional makeup and eliminate such negative manners as anger, pride, conceit, stinginess, envy, and malice, which lead to anxiety and emotional instability. A person's satisfaction with another depends largely on the esteem he holds for him. God is the greatest source of peace for the heart, and remembering him brings pleasure, comfort, and joy to the soul of a believer. It connects a believer to his creator so that he sees beyond the world around him. Consequently, he does not overrate the importance of worldly occurrences so much that they disturb his spirit. The believer constantly deals with the trials throughout his life by practicing patience, determination, courage, hard work, proper behavior, and reliance upon God. He avoids that which causes spiritual malady and weakness, following vain desires, clinging to baseless beliefs, excessive devotion to pleasures, etc., because such things corrupt the heart and endanger the soul. Islam is also concerned with man's physical health and well-being. Hence, it forbids the consumption of anything that is hazardous to the body or can diminish or cause harm to the mind. Because Muslims are serious about their religion, people sometimes ask if they are allowed to enjoy themselves. But who said there is no enjoyment in Islam? Muslims enjoy themselves within the framework of all that God has permitted and feel no regret for missing the few things he prohibited, knowing that they must be harmful in some way. There is no true enjoyment in doing something God has prohibited either, because sin is always followed by a sense of discomfort. A Muslim is content with the countless blessings, apparent and unapparent, that his Creator has bestowed upon him, and deeply appreciates that he has been guided to the best life in both worlds. This is the true happiness of which millions of people are deprived. Anyone who would like to know more about happiness should read some accounts by people who have entered Islam, consider the great changes that occurred in their lives, and the contentment they enjoy now. It is enjoyment that everyone should seek. Warfare and terrorism. Question 46. Why are so many Muslims fundamentalists and extremists? Why are so many Muslim fundamentalists and extremists? This question is often thrown at Muslims directly or indirectly during discussions of religion or world affairs due to the fact that false stereotypes and misinformation about Islam and Muslims are disseminated in the media. Islamic extremism is being repeated incessantly by journalists, writers, and politicians in an attempt to define things from their own particular perspective. The word extremist implies that someone stands far away from the accepted central norm, meaning that he is immoderate, a label that obviously gives expression to negative feelings. Extremism is something blameworthy in Islam, as it means deviation from the moderation of Islamic teachings or from the correct method of applying them. Although the extremist might present his arguments from an Islamic point of view or be motivated by religious feelings, it remains an unacceptable position according to the Quran and guidance of Prophet Muhammad. Consequently, it has been condemned by all reliable Muslim scholars. Extremism is bred by oppression. The most fertile environment for its proliferation is one where people are persecuted, repressed, and denied their natural human rights, making them fearful, angry, and emotionally unstable. In spite of this, Muslims are prohibited from allowing emotion to govern their behavior or acting on their own understanding of religious texts. Rather, they are under strict obligation to take their guidance from qualified scholars regarding the interpretation of those texts and their application to critical contemporary situations. A great deal of attention has been given in Western media recently to the threat of Islamic fundamentalism. The term fundamentalist reflects an intent to stigmatize those Muslims who adhere to the basic fundamental principles of Islam and pattern their lives accordingly. While a practicing Jew is called Orthodox, and a practicing Christian, Hindu, or Buddhist devout, a practicing Muslim is often referred to as a fundamentalist. So what exactly is a fundamentalist? It is someone who strictly adheres to the fundamental beliefs of his religion or his profession. For example, to be a good doctor, one must know and practice the fundamentals of medicine. To be a good mathematician, one must know and practice the fundamentals of mathematics. Similarly, to be a good Muslim, one must know and practice the fundamentals of Islam. The fundamentals of Islam include all noble qualities such as honesty, sincerity, chastity, generosity, and compassion. And they include the moderation which God has enjoined. A true Muslim is pleased to be a fundamentalist because he knows that the fundamentals of Islam are beneficial to the human race as a whole. If one analyzes the teachings of Islam with an open mind, he cannot escape the fact that they are full of benefits both for individuals and their societies. Question number 47. Doesn't Islam promote terrorism, making it a threat to the world? Terrorism is when innocent people are specifically targeted to instill fear in a population. It is categorically prohibited in Islam. The present era of our history has been blemished by indiscriminate violence in almost every society. The loss of innocent life has become extremely commonplace. Unfortunately, due to the actions of some ignorant Muslims as well as biased reporting in the media, the religion of Islam has come to be associated with terrorism. However, the appropriate question to be asked is, do Islamic teachings promote terrorism? As a matter of fact, Islam and terrorism are precise opposites. The very name Islam denotes peace and submission. The fundamentals of Islam directs its followers to maintain and promote peace throughout the world. Islam is a faith of moderation. Thus, a righteous and God-fearing Muslim can neither be a fanatic nor an extremist. There is no connection whatsoever between Islam and the violence practiced by terrorist groups in different parts of the world. In no way does it condone hijackings, hostage taking, and the torture and killing of innocent people in order to achieve particular goals. The Islamic basis for the national and international relations is peace rather than war. Prominent Muslims, Islamic organizations, and Islamic scholars have repeatedly denounced terrorist attacks and terrorism in general. Islam emphatically prohibits and disassociates itself from the violent acts that have been carried out by some of its members in the name of religion. All religions and ideologies have some misguided followers, and it is surely unfair to judge any one of them by the behavior of such people. According to Islam, accordingly, Islam should not be judged by the acts of misguided Muslims or even by the obvious corruption that permeates many Muslim countries. For in fact, what Islam teaches is one thing and what these so-called Muslims practice is something else. The only way to know the truth about Islam is to study its teachings, and they are the standard by which the actions of Muslims can be assessed as being right or wrong. Islam emphasizes the sanctity of life in general, and particularly human life, and the Quran prohibits murder in clear terms, and do not kill the soul which Allah has forbidden to be killed except by legal right. Whoever kills a soul, unless for a soul or for corruption done in the land, it is as if he had slain mankind entirely. And whoever saves one, it is as if he had saved mankind entirely. Such is the value of a single human life that God equates the unjust taking of one life with killing all of humanity. Only a proper and content court can decide whether an individual has forfeited his right to life by commissioning of a major crime. Individual Muslims can never take decisions about who should be killed or promised or punished. Conviction and punishment may not be implemented except by a qualified judge under lawful authority. Terrorism involves the indiscriminate use of force to achieve certain objectives, and in reality it manifests itself in various forms. The head of state who orders the bombing of entire cities, the councils that kill millions of civilians by imposition of sanctions, and the wealthy nations that would rather destroy their surplus food than make it available to those afflicted by famine are rarely punished for crimes against humanity. Although it is recognized that Islamic history was not always filled with virtue, one should justly compare the number of civilians killed by Muslims to the number killed by communists and the Western nations, who ignited two world wars within half a century, deployed the atomic bomb against a civilian population, are currently supporting the brutal Israeli military occupation of Palestine against its civilians, and have brought about the destruction of Iraq while thoroughly terrorizing its citizens. Whilst Islam seeks to promote peace, it also directs its followers to oppose oppression. Both these objectives may on occasion require the use of force. It is precisely for this reason that police use force against criminals and antisocial elements to maintain law and order in society. So Islam does allow taking up arms under particular circumstances. Any civilization that did not could never survive. However, it prohibits the slightest injustice even toward those who oppose the religion. The Quran orders, and do not let the hatred of a people prevent you from being just. Be just what is nearer, that is nearer to righteousness. Enmity toward any people or nation should not provoke Muslims to commit aggression against them or disregard their rights. As for the spread of Islam, this is supposed to take place peacefully by disseminating the message through the written and spoken word. Question 48. Wasn't Islam spread by the sword? Some people claim that Islam would not have millions of adherents all over the world if it had not been spread by military force. Many school textbooks contain the picture of an Arab on a horseback with the Quran in one hand and a sword in the other, symbolizing forcible conversion to the religion. It has never been permitted to compel people to enter Islam by the use of weapons or any other means. If Islam was spread by the sword, then it was the sword of intellect and convincing arguments, the inherent force of truth, reason, and logic, something which conquers the hearts and minds of people everywhere. Far from being spread by the sword, Islam has always accorded respect and freedom of choice to people of all faiths. The Quran instructs, there shall be no compulsion in acceptance of the religion. The right course has become clear from the wrong. Invite to the way of your Lord with wisdom and good instruction, and argue with them in a way that is best. The facts speak for themselves. Indonesia has the largest number of Muslims in the world, and the majority of people in Malaysia are Muslims, but no Muslim army ever went into Indonesia or Malaysia. Muslim traders and educators carried the message of God to those religious and impressed people as outstanding models of honesty and morality. Similarly, Islam spread rapidly on the east coast of Africa, although no Muslim army was ever dispatched to East Africa. Despite the disappearance of Islamic rule from many regions of Asia and Africa, their people have remained Muslims. This shows that the effect of Islam is one of approval and moral conviction, quite in contrast to that of Western colonial occupation, which left its formerly subjugated peoples with painful memories of exploitation, affliction, and oppression. Muslims ruled Spain for over 800 years. It is a documented historical fact that during this period, Christians and Jews enjoyed freedom to practice their respective religions, but therefore under Christian Spain, Muslims and Jews were subjected to tribunals of inquisition and torture. There was no sword of Islam held over non-Muslim minorities in Muslim countries. Until fairly recently, Christian and Jewish minorities have lived peacefully with their Muslim neighbors in the Middle East. If Muslims had made use of the sword, there would be no longer to be Arabs of other religions. Islamic law protects the status of the status of minorities, and in many countries, one can find places of worship belonging to the one for faith. Islamic law also allows non-Muslim minorities to set up their own courts to implement family law, laws drawn by the minorities themselves. The lives and properties of all citizens, whatever their religion, must be safeguarded by an Islamic government. Muslims ruled India for 800 years, during which they possessed enough power and authority to force all the people to convert to Islam. But they did not do so, and thus more than 80% of the population remains non-Muslim. Worldwide statistics for the period from 1934 to 1984 show that adherence to Islam had increased by 235, while adherence to Christianity had increased 47 times. There was obviously no Islamic conquest during that 50-year period. The fastest growing religion in America and Europe today is Islam, in spite of the fact that Muslims in these lands are still small minorities. The only sword they have in their possession is the sword of truth. It is this sword which is converting people to Islam. Question number 49, isn't Islam a militant religion? Among the biggest misconceptions about Islam is that it is a militant religion. A few verses from the Quran are often quoted out of context by its opponents or by those who know little about it in order to perpetuate the myth that Islam promotes violence, bloodshed, and brutality and exhorts Muslims to kill non-believers. To cite one example would be detractors usually quote from the Quran, then kill the polytheist wherever you find them. But in order to understand these words, it is necessary to put them back into their proper context. After several military campaigns in which the pagans of Mecca attempted to annihilate the Muslims, a peace agreement was drawn up between the two sides. The pagans soon violated this treaty, so the Muslim army was instructed to resume combat against those who were fighting them. In light of the historical context of these words, an unbiased person would certainly agree that they cannot be used as proof that Islam promotes violence or orders the killing of anyone outside its fold. The people being referred to in this verse are the pagan Arabs who had been waging war against the Prophet and who had broken their covenant and treaties with him. The verse is not speaking about their pagan Arabs who did not break their treaties and take up arms against Muslims. And most definitely, it is not speaking about the Jews, Christian, or the pagans outside of Arabia. The verse that follows, which is conveniently ignored by the adversaries, completes the picture. If anyone of the polytheists asks you for asylum, then grant him asylum so that he may hear the word, so that he may hear the words of Allah, i.e. the Quran. Then deliver him to his place of safety. That is because they are a people who do not know. What army general today would direct his soldiers to spare an enemy during a battle and then escort him to a place of safety? But this is what God has instructed in the Quran. Islam keeps warfare at a level of mercy and respect for the enemy unlike that of any other system. It orders that armies deal with the enemy justly even on the battlefield and has drawn a clear line of distinction between combatants and non-combatants in enemy territory. Prophet Muhammad instructed his armies, do not kill any old person, child or woman, and do not kill monks in monasteries. For those enemies active in combat and those taken as prisoners of war, the list of rights is lengthy. There should be no torture, no killing of the wounded and defenseless, and no mutilation of enemy corpses. Had the purpose of battle been to force had the purpose of battle been to force unbelievers to accept Islam, the Prophet would never have commanded the Muslims to refrain from hostilities once the enemy had relented and would not have prohibited the killing of priests and monks. Moreover, Islam permits war only in specific and critical circumstances as a last resort when all other attempts at obtaining peace and justice have failed. This is indeed the logical option for any nation. Western countries themselves defend the necessity of war to implement or maintain a peace and do not regard it as a dangerous evil. Muhammad was a prophet of mercy, but he was compelled to turn to battle when certain powers refused mercy and morality and sought to deprive others of them. Sometimes he had to fight for the mere survival of his mission, but the total number of days in the prophet was required to spend in defensive war warfare comes to less than a year, and his most famous battles did not last for more than one day. Once security was ensured, he immediately reverted to peace and diplomacy. The Quran clearly says, fight in the cause of Allah those who fight you, but do not commit aggression. Indeed, Allah does not like aggressor. And if they incline to peace, then incline to it also and rely upon Allah. Indeed, He is the hearing, the all-knowing. Weapons can only be drawn against those who continue to persecute and oppress others and prevent them from following their own consciences in matters of belief. Even when they are compelled to fight and consequently conquer the land, their duty thereafter is to establish God's law and uphold justice for all people, Muslim and non-Muslim. It is not their right to coerce their subjects into accepting Islam. Non-Muslims are allowed to remain on their own faith and to practice it, although they are also expected to respect Islamic laws and not provoke unrest and disorder. Question number 50. What is the meaning of jihad? Jihad is a term often misunderstood and associated with violent radical militants. This Arabic word is frequently mistranslated as holy war, although there is no such thing in Islam. Holy war is something undertaken to forcibly subject others to certain religious duties or doctrines. As we have seen, this is expressly forbidden in Islam. The Arabic word jihad actually means a struggle or striving and applies to any great effort on the personal as well as the social level. It is striving to do good and remove injustice and evil from oneself and from society. This exertion of effort can be spiritual, social, economic, or political. For example, one of the highest levels of jihad is to stand before a tyrant and speak a word of truth. Restraining the self from one wrongdoing is also a form of jihad. It is a broad Islamic concept that includes opposing evil inclinations within the self, opposing injustice by peaceful means, the exertion of effort to improve the quality of life in society, as well as a striving by military forces on a battlefield in defense of the community or of peoples oppressed. Jihad is not synonymous with war, as that is only one possible aspect of the term, and it certainly does not include terrorism. Indeed, the concept of jihad is one of life, and it is vast, not limited only to armed conflict. One finds in the Quran mention of jihad by means of the Quran, meaning invitation to truth, using the best arguments, presentation of evidence, and clarification. And there is jihad of the soul, which means striving to purify the soul, to increase its faith, to incline it toward good, and keep it. This is an Egyptian guy. Then there is jihad through wealth, which means spending it in various beneficial ways, including charities and welfare projects. And there is jihad through the self, which comprises all good works done by a believer. It includes the protection of societies from oppression, foreign domination and dictatorships that usurp rights and freedom, that abolish just and moral rule, that prevent people from hearing the truth or following it, and that practice religious persecution. Jihad endeavors to teach belief in the one supreme God and worship of Him, to spread good values, virtue, and morality through wise and proper methods. Jihad means striving for social reform and elimination of ignorance, superstition, poverty, disease, and racial discrimination. Among its main objectives is securing rights for weaker now. Jihad means striving for social reform and elimination of ignorance, superstition, poverty, disease, and racial discrimination. Among its main objectives is securing rights for weaker members of society against the impositions of the powerful and influential. Armed jihad is not an option for Muslim individuals or groups. It can only be declared by the Muslim head of state and religious leadership. Moreover, it must never be fought for worldly gain, conquest, or revenge. Muslims may only engage in battle to protect people's lives, properties, and freedom. Islam and war. We can consider this as question number 51. Although jihad is a wider concept than war, it is also clear that Islam acknowledges armed struggle when there is no other option for the treatment of such problems as oppression and aggression and the defense of legitimate freedoms and rights. Its purpose is not to convert people to their religion, nor is it to colonize or acquire land and wealth. When Islam permits military engagement, it is as an illegal part of a complete system of values. Inherent in the religion behind which any equitable person can perceive reason and logic. War becomes jihad only when it is waged for the acceptance of God and according to the laws of God. Even self-defense will not be considered jihad if Muslims are striking back in revenge. While Islam encourages oppressed people to strive for liberation and orders Muslims to help those who are oppressed, under no circumstances does it allow indiscriminate killing and terrorizing destruction of homes, animals, and crops, or the torture of prisoners. Jihad has conditions of restraint and that distinguish it from any other kind of warfare. They can be summarized as follows. Muslims may not begin hostilities. They must strive for peace as much as possible. All treaties and agreements must be observed as long as the enemy continues to observe them. Muslims must fight only those who fight against them. Non-combatants are not to be harmed. Weapons of mass destruction must never be used. And collective punishment is strictly prohibited. Muslims might fight only those who fight against them. Non-combatants are not to be harmed. Hostilities should be ended as soon as the other party is inclined to peace. Throughout their history, Muslims have entered battles and armed conflicts under these terms. If the situation is different today, it is only because these Islamic principles are not being observed. When all peaceful means such as dialogue, negotiations, and agreements have failed, and an Islamic government chooses the option of war, it must be confined to the divinely ordained system that is precise, just teaches proper ethics in the situation of war and provides opportunity for peace. The conditions that indicate the kind of warfare lawful to Muslims as a form of jihad show clearly that Islam does not condone aggression against anyone. Finally, dear reader, we now have a few simple questions to ask you. Did you ever wonder, why is a Jew practicing his religion called Orthodox, a Christian practicing his called devout, practicing his religion called Orthodox, a Christian practicing his called devout, but when a Muslim practices his religion, he is labeled a fundamentalist? Why can a nun be covered from head to toe and be respected for devoting herself to God, but when a Muslim woman does that, she is considered fanatic or oppressed? Why, when a non-Muslim steals, rapes, or murders, his religion is irrelevant, but when a Muslim is charged with a crime, it is Islam that goes on trial? Why is it that Prophet Muhammad has been signaled out in Western media for abuse of criticism? But then again, why, in spite of so many negative portrayals, is Islam the fastest growing religion in the world? We would now like our readers to ask themselves what they think are the reasons for all the propaganda and misinformation being spread around. If Islam was just another false religion that made no sense, would so many people need to invent so many falsehoods about it? Our answer is merely that the ultimate truth of Islam stands on unshakable ground, and that its basic fundamental belief in one supreme God is above reproach. Hence, because no one can criticize its doctrines directly, openness can only resort to spreading misinformation about Islam so that people will be deterred from interest in it and lose the desire to find out more. This religion comes from God and it is protected by Him. If any other religion had been exposed to the wars, conspiracies, and plots that Islam has been exposed to, it would have been dispensed with long time ago or essentially altered as other religions have been. This faith, however, has remained unchanged for over 1,400 years, while love of it constantly renews itself in the hearts of the followers, and adherence to it increases with their increase in education and knowledge, further evidence that it is truly God's religion. Islam provides mankind with a reason to live and with an ethical code by which to live. It outlines the dimensions of universal relations with individuals, societies, and all of creation. It protects the institution of the family, upholds principles of justice, self-sufficiency, personal and collective responsibility, and freedom of thought. Islam provides the foundations for a stable society, progress, security, and world peace. If more Muslims were to present Islam correctly and clearly, it would surely make many people reconsider and re-evaluate their own beliefs. It is quite likely that both scholars and lay people, upon finding a universal religion that teaches people to worship God and respect His prophets within a framework of pure monotheism, would at least feel the need to reassess the basis for their own beliefs and doctrines, and it is that to which all people are invited by the Quran. Yes, Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world today, and it has the answer to problems facing the modern world. Do not judge the religion by what you see on television or by what some Muslims or so-called Muslim leaders are doing. Study it from its authentic sources and speak to sincere practicing Muslims. Study it from its authentic sources and speak to sincere practicing Muslims. You will surely find a different picture than that projected by the media. You may even find that Islam is what you have been looking for all your life. May God guide you to the truth and guide all of us with you. Alhamdulillah.